Life could be a dream. Life could be a dream. Do 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 shaboom. 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 Oh, life could be a dream. Shaboom, if I could take you up in paradise up above. Shaboom, and tell me, darling, I'm the only one that you love. Life could be a dream. Sweetheart, hello, hello again. Shaboom, and hope for me again. Life could be a dream. Life could be a dream. Do, 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 shaboom.
Well, welcome to Menlo. For all of you joining us online and at all of our campuses, welcome back to our final week of the series Good People. I hope you had a nice Thanksgiving. For a lot of folks, Thanksgiving is a time to be with family and friends and loved ones. We gather around the table to give thanks and to reflect on God's goodness. But for some people, Thanksgiving is one of those dreaded holidays, the obligatory visit to see people you may not be on good terms with. It gives a whole new definition to Psalm 23 when David says, "You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies." Now, you may not call the people you spent Thanksgiving with your enemies, but there's another clever word to describe someone you don't want to be around but have to. It's the word frenemy. The word frenemy has become quite popular in our culture. It's an oxymoron that consists of the two words friend and enemy. A frenemy is someone who pretends to be close and on good terms, but is actually a rival or has ulterior motives. Sigmund Freud said of himself that an intimate friend and a hated enemy have always been indispensable to his emotional life. Not infrequently, friend and enemy have coincided in the same person. Even Freud had frenemies. When I was in the fourth grade, I had a frenemy. His name was Danny. I thought I was smarter than him, more athletic than him, and even more popular than him. And then one day, there was an epic showdown between me and Danny. We both ran for class president. I was sure that I'd win in a landslide vote. But to my surprise, he was the one that was voted for president instead of me. So that whole year, I held a grudge and I resented him. And I kept on pretending that everything was okay when I was really trying to find a way, anyway, to have him impeached. You see, politics, whether you're in elementary school or all grown up, has a way of drawing a line in the sand and creating alliances between friends and enemies. Do you have any frenemies? There's a story of a pastor who preached on forgiving your enemies at his church. And he asked everyone in his congregation to stand if they were willing to forgive their enemies. But the pastor noticed that there was one man in his congregation who didn't stand up. So he called him out and said, "Mr. Jones, are you not willing to forgive your enemies?" And Mr. Jones replied, "I don't have any enemies to forgive." And the pastor said, that's weird. You mean to tell me that you've lived your whole life without having a single enemy?" And Mr. Jones said, "I'm 95 years old. And I don't have any enemies to forgive because I outlived all those scumbags." Former President Richard Nixon was known to have an actual enemies list. It was a list of his political opponents and people he didn't like. A member of the White House Counsel explained the purpose of the list: how we can maximize the fact of our incumbency in dealing with persons known to be active in their opposition to our administration. Stated a bit more bluntly, how we can use the available federal machinery to screw our political enemies. At one point, it was said that there were over 500 names on Nixon's enemy list. One person on the list was the actor Paul Newman, and he said making Nixon's list was one of the greatest life accomplishments for him. I guess Paul Newman didn't like Richard Nixon all that much either. Now, you may not have a list like Nixon's, but I bet you have a mental list of people who've wronged you, people you don't like, people you can't stand to be around, people you avoid, people you talk about to others in a way that disparages their character or reputation. people who you wouldn't care if something bad were to happen to them. In the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus is forming a community of people who will follow his way of life. And the most important characteristic he wants to instill in them is the ethic of loving relationships. Jesus' intent is to confront and address anything in his kingdom that would threaten loving relationships. Jesus is creating a new standard for people, for relationships. And at the end of Matthew chapter 5, he says something really radical. In fact, I think it's the most radical thing anyone has ever said. But not only did Jesus say this, he actually lived it out. And no one since Jesus has taught this and lived by it who wasn't simply referring back to what Jesus said. This is what Jesus said. You have heard that it was said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I tell you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, that you may be children of your Father in heaven. Not only is this an incredible statement, it's also probably one of the most ignored and disregarded things Jesus commanded his followers to do. We don't take this one very seriously. I mean, he's kidding, right? How many of us can honestly say we've loved our enemies? Right here, for the first time in Matthew chapter 5, we meet the word which sums up the entirety of Jesus' message, the word love. German theologian Dietrich Bonhoeffer says, love is defined in uncompromising terms as Jesus teaches to love our enemies. Had Jesus only told us to love our neighbor, our family, our friends, people we like, we might have misunderstood what he meant by love, but he leaves no doubt as to its meaning. For Jesus' listeners, the enemy was not an abstraction. As these words came out of Jesus' mouth, they knew exactly who he was referring to. You see, for over 500 years, Israel was under the oppression of Rome. Many of them were persecuted for their faith. Freedom and peace was something they could only imagine, but had never experienced personally. To them, it was clear who the enemy was. For them, it was Rome. And then Jesus says, do not resist an evil person. If anyone slaps you on the right cheek, turn to them the other cheek also. And if anyone wants to sue you and take your shirt, hand over your coat as well. If anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go with them 2 miles. Give to the one who asks you, and do not turn away from the one who wants to borrow from you. For Jesus' followers, it wouldn't be unusual for a Roman soldier to take out their frustration on one of them. At any time, a Roman soldier could backhand a Jew if they were having a bad day or feeling the slightest bit frustrated or maybe impatient or just wanted to exert their power and their influence over someone. Also, they could take anything they wanted from you without asking or without a good reason. Because to them, they owned everything, and they owned everyone. If they liked your shirt, they could ask you to take it off and hand it over. If they wanted your sandals, same deal. Take them off and give them up. And then the third thing Jesus referred to was when a Roman soldier would force a Jew to carry their bags and their luggage. By Roman law, you had to carry their luggage for a mile upon command. At any moment, a Roman soldier could do this, and you had to carry his belongings for an entire mile. Imagine being under this type of oppressive force your entire life. And then Jesus comes along and says, love your enemies. Love these soldiers. Love Rome. Nietzsche said, the command to love one's enemies is a testimony to the fact that the Christian ethic is designed for the weak and the cowardly, and not for the strong and courageous. In other words, Nietzsche called Jesus an impractical idealist. But that's not at all what Jesus is asking his followers to do. He's not calling them to be passive doormats for their enemies. If a Roman guard were to come up and give you the backhand, The kingdom response would be to say, do you need another one of those? Please, go ahead, put another one right here. Go ahead and get it out. Or if a soldier took something from you, the response would be to ask if he needed anything else. Please, take my jacket. Would you like my scarf too? They go really well together. Please, it'd be my pleasure for you to have them both. And if the same Roman soldier threw their bags on your back to carry them for a mile, the response Jesus is calling for is to say, can I just carry your things all the way home? I'd be more than happy to do that so you can take it easy. You look tired. It would be my honor. You see, there's nothing weak and cowardly about that. That's actually quite bold and courageous. And now, 2,000 years later, as we read about and study this command from Jesus, who is it that comes to your mind when you hear him say, love your enemies? Maybe it's someone you made a promise to and then broke it. Or maybe it's someone in your family, and Thanksgiving was a reminder that after all these years, nothing's changed or gotten any better. Things are still pretty dysfunctional. Or it could be someone who vowed to love you till death do you part, and they didn't honor that vow, and they walked away. Or maybe it's a former business partner or a coworker. Or don't look now. Maybe it's the person sitting right next to you. I said, don't look. See, it's easy to get hurt and bruised by people in this world. Hardly anyone will go through life without collecting a few people who would not care if something bad happened to them or if they died. But Jesus tells his disciples, my command is this, love each other as I have loved you. You see, when Jesus was saying this to his group of disciples, I'm sure there were some who weren't so fond of each other. Maybe they were jockeying for Jesus' attention and his favor to be noticed by him. Maybe there was a bit of competitiveness going on in that circle of 12 men. But Jesus said, the whole world will know you are my disciples if you love one another. Not by how many miracles you can perform or how great of a preacher you are, but it's really by how you love each other. Later on, the Apostle Paul reiterates this command in Galatians 5, and he writes, the only thing that counts is faith expressing itself through love. Now, there are a lot of things written in the Bible, a lot of commands, a lot of do's and don'ts, but none of them matter if you don't have love. Without love, Paul says, you have nothing. You see, these words are not just radical. They are incredibly powerful and have the capacity to transform lives, relationships, and entire communities. And before we ask how this is possible, how to love our enemies, it's important to understand what Jesus meant when he used the word love. You see, in the English language, we get a lot of mileage out of the word love. We use it for so many different things. It can make this command unclear and easily misunderstood. We don't want to confuse the word Jesus is using for love with something just sentimental. Love is so much more. It's so much deeper than that. For instance, if I say I love tacos, I'm using the word to express a food preference. I prefer tacos over pizza. Or I can say that I love coffee and how it wakes me up in the morning. I'm using the word love there to describe how coffee makes me feel, how I experience it. But then I can use the same word, love, and express it to my family. I love my kids and I love my wife. And this is less about my preference and how they make me feel, although those are both important. It's more about my affection and loyalty and commitment and service. You see, those are all so different from each other, and yet we have one word in English to describe all of those things. But mostly, when we use the word love, it refers to a feeling, an emotion. And Jesus means something very different than that when he tells us to love our enemies. Jesus here uses the Greek word agape. Agape is the love of God at work in a human heart. It's loving someone not because you like them or because you prefer them or because they appeal to you. We simply love them because God loves them. At the most basic level, we love the person who does something evil to us, although we hate the evil thing that he or she does. It's an unconditional love. It's agape. Jesus is not asking us to have warm, fuzzy feelings for someone who hates us, but he's asking us to think of them in a different kind of way. In God's kingdom, this person is beloved. They are a human being created in God's image. And they may not be perfect, but they still reflect God's image. He says, if you love those who love you, for instance, what reward will you get? Jesus is acknowledging that people are basically good to each other. It's easy to be good to someone who is good to you. That's basic human nature. The problem is, we love people in our kingdom, and we don't love people who are in other kingdoms. For instance, we all did something like this today. When you walked into the room today, you probably gave a warm welcome, a greeting, to someone you know, to someone who's going to return the welcome and the warmth. That's just how we operate. But there's something about a person who steps out of their comfort zone, who steps across a boundary line, and performs an act of concrete benevolence and generosity and kindness. Jesus says people are never more like God than when they are in that moment. There's something about love, choosing to love someone regardless of who they are or what they've done for you or what they've done to you. Jesus illustrates this kind of love by comparing this behavior to the way creation, the way nature works. He points to the sun and the rain and where God causes the sun to rise on the evil and the good. He sends rain on the righteous and the unrighteous. Now, what does Jesus mean by this? What is he trying to say? If you've ever been to a farm, you can't tell simply by looking at a lush field and say, oh, that person must be spiritually mature and close to God, a friend of God. And then you look in another direction and see a dried up field where everything is shriveled up and say, that person must be an enemy of God. That person must be evil or horrible. Just look at their field. You can tell by their field. You actually can't tell anything about someone's character simply by looking at their farm. And Jesus is saying, the farmer who is honest and upright gets the same weather, the same rain, and the same sun as the farmer who is dishonest, the one who lies, the one who cheats, the one who pays his workers poorly. That farmer gets the same life-giving rain that everyone across the valley receives. See, Jesus knows people who deserve a good life and people who don't deserve a good life. But everyone gets rain and everyone receives sun. And because God's kingdom works differently from the world's kingdom, there's something in creation that also reveals the nature of God, his character. And this is what it reveals. God doesn't just reserve good things for good people. God's love is generous, it's gracious, and it's compassionate. If you love your enemies, despite the way they treat you or the way you feel about them, if you love them, then you too are displaying the characteristics of God's kingdom, the upside down and the inside out reality of Jesus' influence of his kingdom. At some point, God will make all things right and hold all of humanity accountable for how we all behave, but in this moment, it's a moment of pure grace and generosity, no matter how people behave toward you, whether they treat you like a friend or treat you like an enemy. And Jesus draws a very powerful conclusion. If that is what God is like, then what must the people of his kingdom be like? I can't think of anyone who has expressed this in more relevant modern ways than Martin Luther King. There's no doubt of the unjust sufferings which Martin Luther King had to endure and suffer. in one of his most moving sermons entitled Loving Your Enemies, which was actually written from a jail cell in Georgia, he described how hate multiplies hate. In a descending spiral of violence, and is just as injurious to the person who hates as to his victim. But love is the only force capable of transforming an enemy into a friend. We never get rid of an enemy by meeting hate with hate. We get rid of an enemy by getting rid of enmity. By its very nature, hate destroys and tears down. By its very nature, love creates and builds up. Love transforms with redemptive power. Love has the power to transform a person, a relationship, and a community. And here we are 5 decades later after the life of Martin Luther King Jr., in awe of someone who lived by this powerful command to love one's enemies. We named streets after him, and he simply lived out Jesus' command to love one another, whether they were a friend, an enemy, or both. There were a lot of people who treated Martin Luther King as an enemy. But do you know who had even more enemies? Jesus did. In Peter's letter to the church, he wrote, "When they hurled insults at Jesus, he did not retaliate. When he suffered, he made no threats. Instead, he entrusted himself to him who judges justly. He himself bore our sins in his body on the cross so that we might die to sins and live for righteousness. By his wounds, you have been healed." Anyone who has ever sinned is an enemy of Jesus. But Jesus made his enemies into friends with love and by giving his life on the cross. So how do we love our enemies? Let me give a few suggestions. First, develop the capacity to forgive. Enmity usually begins with someone who sins against you. Maybe they've hurt you or offended you or let you down. Without the capacity to forgive, there is no power to love. And forgiveness is most powerful when it comes from the one who was hurt, the one who was betrayed. The person who inflicted the pain can ask for forgiveness, but when the one who was on the receiving end extends grace and forgiveness, the power of love will start to break down enmity, hostility, and division. Second, recognize your own sin and your own shortcomings. Martin Luther King said, "There is some good in the worst of us and some evil in the best of us." When we realize this truth that we are not perfect, we are less likely to despise others and think less of them. The sooner you realize you're a sinner, that you're not perfect, that you fall short, the sooner you'll experience God's grace for you and engage with it so that you can extend it to others. And last, pray. Pray for anyone you are struggling to love. Instead of hoping for something bad to happen to someone you don't like or can't stand you, make it your mission to change your attitude toward this person and surprise them with kindness and compassion. Prayer is one of the deepest forms of love because it means that you really want something good to happen to them, for them to be blessed by God. And I know for some, the pain, the hurt, the suffering, the enmity, it goes so deep. And if this is you, I know it'll take time. Jesus knows the pain you feel, the isolation of being in a relationship or a situation where you feel powerless, and his grace is available to you. The command to love your enemy is a command to begin setting your mind on God's kingdom and not on the things of this earth. The command to love your enemy is a command to find your hope and your peace in God and in his great reward, not in the way people treat you. Loving your enemy doesn't earn you the rewards of God's kingdom. Treasuring and savoring the blessings of God's kingdom is what empowers you to love people you don't like and who don't like you. And so this week, I wonder if any of us will be around people who are difficult to love, someone you have a hard time with. If you can think of someone who might fall under this category, ask yourself, what could you do to adopt a different kind of mindset and do something for them that would be surprising, counterintuitive, and then just see what happens inside of you and inside that relationship. We were all at one time on God's enemy list. And at the cross, we moved onto his friends list. And when we realize the price that was paid to make us friends with God, it's pretty hard to hold a grudge. Now, go and love somebody.